All this technology. It's hard to keep up. So I need to finish with new beginnings. And I mentioned at the start that I'd be trying to distill out of that chapter, which I think could be his next book, the three things that were very moving to me. And the first we talked about was yearning and longing, and the idea that that's a visceral thing, that we can experience it in our bodies. And actually, I was grateful a couple of you mentioned that to me at the break, that sense of, I gotta go. And a lot of the time we don't listen to it, but it can be very profound. And it's scary. It's scary. I was sharing that I've gone to Iona more often than not by myself. And that's a big journey to make by yourself. But what happens to pilgrims on the way is you meet incredible people. I've met artists and poets and actually, the origins of my knitting started on Iona because I was there for work week. It's when people can come back and help prepare the abbey and the housing for winter. And I chose to come then because, again, work and prayer works for me. But every night, you know, there's no TV, no internet, nothing. Yeah, Mary says it sounds great. It is. And so we were sitting around the fire in the chapter room, and mostly Scots, the people were, and everybody had something to do. People were making rugs. They were whittling. Several women were knitting. And after the second night, I said, could you give me something? Just something. And I ended up making strips for a rug. But I realized that doing work with my hands was something I needed to learn about. And I ended up buying some yarn. And there on the island, they're now starting to create their own Iona yarn from the sheep. It's single-sourced. And those of you that knitter know that to get it from the sheep and the whole process happening in a place is really wonderful. And so I started knitting. And then I decided, I met women who, you know, waited till they had grandchildren to create garments and things. And I thought, to heck with that. I'm going to start now. So I made hats and blankets and booties, and we put them out in the garage in a rubber container. And when Connor and Josh came to let us know they were pregnant, I said to Biff, go get the box. And I felt so ahead of myself because I had hats and whatnot. So who would have thought, especially those of you who know me for a long time, that I'd be a knitter and a quilter and, you know, now I'm a felter. And so these journeys take us a lot of places. Anyway, longing, yearning, inward journey, outward journey. And as in conversation at the break, a number of you said, you know, I either can't travel or whatnot. You don't have to go to India. You don't even have to go to Iona. I had a profound experience of pilgrimage in the sanctuary of Trinity Episcopal Church. So it can happen here. Another place is to make a pilgrimage in your own home. There was a movement a while back for doing house blessings, and I did quite a few where we bless each room. Well, to see it as a pilgrimage place can be very profound as well. Well, the last thing I want to mention is the last thing first, new beginnings. What is being reborn in your life? What are you midwifering or midwifing into the world? It's a similar longing. It comes from that deep place. One of the outward and visible signs of endings and new beginnings, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, are cairns. And you see them all over Scotland, and more you see them in this country, too. Piles of stones, and they can go this way and this way, and there are even a couple of people down at the beach here in Santa Barbara who made some beautiful cairns. And the idea is a cairn marks a sacred place. Dunee, there's a big stone cairn there. It marks a sacred place. So making piles of stones became a real interest of mine. I found myself doing it more and more when I came to a place that felt special to me. And a few years ago, as I approached my 60th birthday, I decided I wanted to build a cairn for my 60th birthday. And I built that cairn with 60 stones. And I built that cairn with 60 stones from all over, because I kind of like heart stones and, you know, I have a lot of stones to work with. But where? Where do you build a cairn on your 60th birthday that's a sacred place? And then it came to me. Mount Laber. Do you know of it? Probably not. Mount Laber, well, Laber was my maiden name. I was Susan Virginia Laber. And my father was the camping director for the LA Council of Boy Scouts, and he ended his professional career being the director of camping for Orange County Council. After he died, the council, to honor him, decided to name one of the mountains at Lost Valley Ranch, their community camp, summer camp area, after my father, Mount Laber. And I hadn't been able to go there at the time of the dedication. It's a rather remote spot. It's outside of Temecula. And it's not your typical High Sierra camp place. It's a little more rugged than that. But I said to my husband, I need to go, and I need to see Mount Laber, and I want to put my cairn there. Well, as with most pilgrimages, you never know what you've asked for. The road out to Lost Valley Scout Camp is rather challenging. We were there after there'd been some torrential rain, so there were big... I kept saying, how do they get buses down this road? I knew my father had been very active and whatnot, but, you know, I was a married woman when he died with a baby and things, well, two babies, and things were busy, so I didn't connect in quite the same way. So as we came into camp and we'd gotten permission to be there, and we went down this rutted dirt road, we came into a picnic area with tables and a barbecue, and there was this sign, a plaque dedicated to my father. And one of the things that continues to move me is that tall leader of the forest, that was his sacred name in the Order of the Arrow. Some of you may be familiar with that. And this idea he tried to instill in leaders that your job is to make them thirsty. I'd never known that before, so it was worth just that journey to connect. But on arrival, we learned that the old trail that used to go to the top of the mountain was no longer there because they put the rifle range in front of the trail. And so it, over a couple of years, you know, it had evaporated. Plus, they didn't want kids hiking up to the top of this mountain with, you know, ammunition going off. So we were going to have to go through the bushes to get to the top. And there were oak trees and I'm sure some poison oak, although we were pretty well prepared for that. And plus, I hadn't figured about carrying a backpack with 60 stones. And they all weren't big stones, you know, they were various sizes. I was building a small cairn, but oh my goodness, it was sweat equity all the way. And we finally reached a place that overlooked the valley. And this valley is kind of, it's round with little hillocks. I wouldn't call this a mountain high, but, you know, you look down in the valley, and I thought about how my father must have, he loved that place. He loved that place. And I built a cairn for my father with 60 stones. I don't know if it's still there. I don't know how it would be a way marker for anything else than squirrels and the occasional deer. But it was a ritual I had not intended would mark a letting go of my father in a way I hadn't before. And opening up for myself a new window on aging. At 60 and moving forward, what was important? What do I need or want or long for? And I marked that place as both an ending, a letting go, and a new beginning. We mentioned the Camino. And any of you who've seen the way, or maybe someone here has been on the Camino in Spain, good. It is an incredible walk. There are different routes to Santiago, from the north, the south. We met people making the pilgrimage from all over the world. And there are lots of waymarkers along the way. And people are always building piles of stones or cairns to mark a sacred place for themselves. But this is the archetypal symbol of the Camino. And as you walk, in our case, we were in Spain, that symbol can be up, which means straight on, or left, you go left, go right. It's pretty simple signage, but it works. Occasionally, there are statues or silhouettes. And, of course, St. James figures prominently everywhere as the ultimate pilgrim journey. Pilgrims who have come there over the centuries came with very simple things. You wear your garment, where you keep everything, and maybe have a little sack with some food, and then the shell, the icon of St. James, is prevalent, and you wear that on your journey. The people along the way, the greetings, bien camino, have a good camino. People offering us water and food, and it's quite an incredible pilgrim journey. Well, of course, the ultimate goal is to reach the cathedral, and I have to say that when you go and you come into Santiago, that's the first place you go. You don't stop at your hotel, you just go to the cathedral, because that's the end of your journey. And when we arrived, I, as often I said, you know, I just need some time to pray and meditate, so why don't you go to the hotel, and I'll meet you in an hour or so. So I'm there praying, and I'm just deep in prayer, and it gets quieter and quieter, and I think, man, I'm there, you know, I'm getting there. And then I realize there's nobody there except me. And I hear voices off in the corner, and I walk around, and there was a priest organizing probably 25 people, which I could tell right away were international. He was speaking Spanish, and I know enough to know, to understand that he was gathering us for a pilgrimage inside the cathedral. And the first thing we were to do, he took us out on this patio. And he said, I know you've all come a long way, and as you've made this journey, you've let go of so many things. But I sense there's something else you need to let go of here. And he passed out little pieces of paper and invited us to write the one last thing we needed to let go of. And then he collected them and he burned them. And he said, now you can begin. Now you can begin the journey. It was very profound. And then to make the stations of pilgrimage, which is a huge cathedral. It's you could have elephants going through, and it's still, you know, some of these ancient cathedrals, they're just overwhelming. And I just felt so graced, you know. Not only had I had my Camino, but I'd had this Camino in the church, this walk. So, floating on air, I left, and I couldn't see my husband anywhere out on the plaza, and pretty soon he walked up to me and was very angry. And he said, "I've been here for over 2 hours. What in the hell were you doing in there?" And he said, "I was ready to get the police." And you think about it, we're in a foreign country. He speaks Spanish, mine's not too well, and I disappear. And it was kind of like Jesus must have felt when he stayed in the temple and his parents said, "Where have you been?" He was with God. He was, you know, and I was kind of in one of those. We've worked it out, right? Yes. But I've learned that if you say it's going to be an hour, you better to say two. But that pilgrimage within the pilgrimage was very significant for me. Well, we spent several days in Santiago. If you go there, and I think this is true for Lourdes or any sacred place, don't go in and out. Don't make it a day trip. Be there. Have coffee. Watch, in this case, the pilgrims coming from all over the world, some on bicycles, some handicapped. You stand in line to get your certificate. And if you've walked at least 120 miles, you are given a certificate. It's quite beautiful. Ours are framed at home. And they write your name in Latin on this certificate. It's very, very beautiful. And as you're waiting to go up to have this done, it's all handwritten and everything, you meet all these other people and you hear this chatter from all over the world and the pilgrims that have come together. And it's really, really quite moving. Well, on, I don't know, the third day we were there, and the food is fabulous. If you haven't traveled in northern Spain, I mean, best croissants I've ever had. I just... Anyway, café au lait, coffee con leche. So we were enjoying ourselves, and there's music, and just watching all of it was fabulous. But I noticed on the south portico, there was a really interesting set of carvings that I couldn't really understand. And And it focused on this particular area. I know it's hard to see, but this is way up high, so my camera did a pretty good job. I will. So you see on either side of the figures there, a chrism. And in the chrism is not Alpha and Omega, but Omega and Alpha. The juxtaposition of what we're normally used to. Well, that really caught my attention. And I said, "If we've got to find out about that, what does that mean? The ending is the beginning. Christ is the end and the beginning. What do we do?" So we started chatting up. In the cathedral, they have little individuals who are shushing people at appropriate times, and we went to one of the shushers who led us to another shusher. Finally, we got to one who said, "Oh, I know what that means." And I want to read you, this is from my book, but it really speaks to what this is. "The southern facade of the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, known as the Puerta de las Plateneras, is the oldest facade in the cathedral. It was sculpted between 1112 and 1117. On this magnificent portico resting on the backs of two lions, one now headless, is chiseled a chrism, a symbol or monogram of Christ. The chrism, which consists of the letters Chi and Rho, were first featured by Constantine the Great in the 4th century on his shields as a standard bearer for Christianity. When superimposed on one another," and you can kind of see that in the middle, it's a little worn, "these letters refer to the name of Jesus Christ, and they are often placed within a circle which is symbolic of the death and resurrection of Christ. On the facade in the cathedral, suspended from the arms of the chrism, are the first and last letters of the classical alphabet, Alpha and Omega, which call from the book of Revelations, I'm the beginning and the end. But here, they're in juxtaposition. The individual said, this is done to try and express that the end of the way to Santiago symbolizes a new beginning, a new life that you will experience from this day forward. So even in the 1100s, it was understood that Santiago is a beginning, the beginning of the journey. And I think that one of the things this chapter does so well is challenge us to that. Many of you know of the work of David White. He was a great friend of John O'Donohue's, and I was privileged to do a retreat with him in San Diego. And like John Philip, if you get a chance to meet John White, he's the real deal. He doesn't read his poems, he just speaks them, which I thought was incredible. In his relatively new book called Consolations, The Solace, Nourishment, and Underlying Meaning of Everyday Words, he talks about pilgrimage, and I just want to offer this. Most of all, a pilgrim is someone abroad in the world of impending revelation where something is about to happen, including, most fearfully, and as part of their arrival, their own disappearance. And he's talking about our death. Interestingly, he died shortly. John O'Donohue died not too long after he was working on this material. And he accompanied his body. They actually took his casket to the top of the mountain in Ireland that he loved. And David Wyatt was one of the people that did that. He goes on to write, it might be that faith, reliability, responsibility, and being true to something unspeakable are possible even if we are travelers, and that we are made better, more faithful companions, and indeed pilgrims, on the astonishing, never-to-be-repeated journey by combining the previous memory of the then, memory, the then, with the astonishing, but often taken for granted, now, and both the unbelievable, but hardly possible, just about to happen. That's what I think this journey, it circles around to that. The then, I had a father. The now, in the moment when I was making a life transition, to what's before me, what's happening now, then, now, and just about to happen. I did want to read a quote from John O'Donohue. I love his book. And this is a little bit from Bless the Spaces Between Us. Blessing the, it's a wonderful book of blessing. He writes, as far as you can, hold your confidence. Do not allow your confusion to squander this call that is loosening your roots in false ground. That you might come free from all that you have outgrown. We build a pile of stones. We make an ending so we can have a new beginning. Yeah. Let's see. As far as you can, hold your confidence. Do not allow your confusion to squander this call, which is loosening your roots in false ground, that you might come free from all that you have outgrown. I think as we age, that's so important. God's not finished with us yet. And as I said earlier, I think for me, the questions just become more abundant. I don't know why I ever thought it would all get clear. That's sure not going to happen. But the ability to live with ambiguity and still be on the way. My older daughter is a very professional woman. She likes to be in control. First child. Well, this new baby is not letting that happen. She's breech. They tried turning. It's not working. She's going to have to decide whether she wants to go in and have the doctor turn it. But that's 50-50. And it could start labor. Then, does she want to have a C-section and schedule it? I mean, she is a mess. And I found my, this is, you hate mothers that say stuff like this, but I said, well, you know, a sign of maturity, I read this from a psychologist long ago, is the ability to live with ambiguity. And she said, I'll talk to you later. We did talk later, and that was good. But I think when we, as we age, we are, the invitation is to live the questions in a more deep way. I remember years ago being at a workshop that was primarily for retirees, and it was on sexual harassment, and I had to go, but I couldn't go with everybody else. So I went with all these retirees, men and women in the Congregational Church. And there was a beautiful woman who came in late. I'm sure she was well into her 80s, but she was just, her energy was so positive. And she sat down. Of course, all the women were sitting at one table together, and the men kind of. But these were women who'd been in, ordained in that tradition in the 50s. So they, you know, they had a lot going on, a lot of history. And this woman sat down, and they live at Pilgrim Place down in Pasadena, which is a retirement community. And they looked at her and said, why are you late? You should have been here an hour ago. And, you know, the program's starting. She looked at them and she said, you know, every morning I meditate and prepare for my death. Now, I'm thinking, wow, I want to know more about that. And it had to do, in her case, with life review, with walking on a path of memory, a pilgrimage to memory, and remembering the piles of stones built all along the way. And I thought, what a profound thing to do, to say, I'm going to meditate and prepare for my death. Well, boy, the time flies when we're having fun, right? You'll notice on your table are some smooth stones. Now, I want to tell you, first of all, they're not from Iona. They're from Arroyo Borough, but I picked them up myself, and they're all washed and clean. And I know that stones figure so much in this book, and I thought we'd take heart from John Philip on what the ritual at the Bay of Blessings, St. Columbus Bay. There are stones everywhere. There are piles of stones. And the ritual there is to take two and to throw one into the sea, which is something you want to let go of, and to keep one with you to remember that yearning, that longing that's being born in you. So I'm going to invite you to do that today before you leave, but I want you to know there's a magic potion on these stones. That sand came from Iona. I collect sand, too. But as I was getting ready for this day, I thought, oh, my gosh, I've got sand from Iona. I may not have the stones, but I've got the. So I've mixed the sand with the stones. If you want to take two stones and eliminate one yourself, that's fine. If you want to leave one on the table, I'm going to take these back to Hendry's and put them back on the beach. But I'm going to sift that sand out first. It's very valuable. So I'd like to close with the prayer that we use on the day retreat on Iona at Columbus Bay. And it comes from the Iona prayer book. And now may kindly Columba guide you to be an island in the sea, to be a hill on the shore, to be a star in the night, to be a staff for the weak. Amen. Thank you.
And we do have time for some questions if anybody wants to come and make a comment.
The last one, I forgot. That's the cathedral. There's a big plaza, and those stairs are where people sit and wait for their loved ones when they get lost. So, yes, Mary. Oh, yeah, you know to come.
Susan, first of all, I want to thank you. I had the privilege of working with Susan for 11 years at Cottage when she first opened the spiritual care department.
In 1911.
1911. We were there. And she was a wonderful mentor and friend and guide, and the experience of Susan changed my life for the better. One of her favorite sayings at the end of any little note that she would leave me, let me just do this, is blessings. And ever since then, whenever I write an email, unless it's something official, I always say blessings. And it's from Susan.
Well, thank you, Mary.
The one thing I wanted to ask, Susan, is I think the wind beneath your wonderful wings is Biff, and I think he deserves some applause.
Oh, yes! You're right. He's walked the Camino. He walked St. Cuthbert's. He hasn't been to India yet, but we'll see.
But to allow you to go and to trust not only that you can do this, but that God will protect you. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you, Mary. I really do. Thank you.
And then I have one quick question. How do you identify a Sikh person from someone else who might be wearing a turban?
Okay. There are five Ks in Sikhism that kind of reveal who they are as opposed to others. There's a way the turban's tied. That's part of it. But the reason turbans are worn is that the hair is never cut. It is believed that every hair on your body, everything about you is God-given, so you don't cut your hair. So I've seen sick men when they take the turban off. I remember in The English Patient, the sick dynamite guy, and he took his off, and you could see this beautiful head of hair. So they do unwrap, and there are different colors for different times. More often than not, Sikhs wear blue. That's, I think, because of the gurdwara and the water and all of that. Another symbol that really tells you right away that a Sikh is worshiping, and remember, you could be Sikh culturally or spiritually, but the men and women wear a metal bracelet. And it's steel, usually, and it's a symbol that the continuation of your connection with God and the strength of your faith. Now, another thing that's been quite controversial in this country is a dagger. And the dagger is a symbol, very important, because the Sikhs were warriors. And part of that warrior sense is you are prepared to protect and defend injustice. So you won't see, well, in India you'll see Sikhs with big swords, but generally it's just a very small symbolic item that they wear. Another is a comb, but usually you can't see the comb. It's usually embedded in their hair under the turban. But twice a day, you're supposed to use this wooden comb to clean your hair and do that. The last thing, again, you wouldn't necessarily see it, but practicing Sikhs wear a special underwear. And it was very important because it's just kind of like shorts with a tie. And they wear that because, again, to remind themselves of their obligation to defend. Sikhs would sleep in that, And it was very easy to just put on other clothing and be prepared to go out and do what needed to be done. So, again, it's the turban. And I always look when I meet someone, I always look for the metal bracelet, the steel bracelet, because that says sick.
Susan, I wanted to just an add on here about Biff. There are many of us, several of us in the audience, who have had Professor Willis Copeland at UCSB. He was instrumental in my getting my master's degree. So there's several of us that had him on our journey before. Thank you, Professor Copeland. And then the
and he's granddaddy now. So.
The other thing I wanted to add, and I don't know that if Susan talked about it, but the reason that we did the pilgrimage inside the Abbey, because there was a hurricane going on the outside.
And you spoke about some of the places you thought were good pilgrimages in the United States. The cemetery, national parks, the Korean War, is it like a monument, or what is that?
You know, in Washington, D.C., if you've never been there, it really is worth a visit. There are a number of memorials, and more often than not, we think of the wall, which is incredibly powerful. But I was really moved by this. Some of you may have seen it, the memorial to the Korean vets, because it's these figures in action. It's not just... I mean, we need all kinds of memorials, but to see these men, life-size, really hit home for me.
Well, then you also mentioned, I think, a cathedral where they make caskets?
Yes.
What is that?
Are any of you familiar with New Millery Abbey?
How do you spell
it's,
that?
M-E-L-L-E-R-E-Y. Millery.
Okay.
It's outside Dubuque, Iowa.
Oh,
and I was actually led there by reading a book about their casket making. And they made a casket for the little girl who was shot, now I'm forgetting her name, when Gabby Giffords was killed.
Oh, yeah.
And I had heard, just an aside, that... the casket had been made and donated by the monks at New Millery, and that they planted a tree for her. And then I went online and I read their prayer. They bless each casket that they make and cremation urns. My poor husband, I said, I got to go there. I got to find out what this is because it's holy work. So I flew to Dubuque and went and did a retreat at the monastery there. And just across the road from the monastery is their casket fabrication.
Oh, wow.
And it's wonderful because the trees are from their property.
Hmm.
And they're, you know, this is a pretty active monastery. They're younger and older. They do have help from the local community, which has provided jobs in milling the trees. And then at this factory, all the caskets are made right there.
Huh.
And this was very profound for me, especially when I was doing bereavement work. They will donate a casket to any family with a child that's been killed or died. So it's quite an incredible ministry.
Were there any other places in the U.S. that you recommend?
I think retreat, I mean, the Casa de Maria.
Yeah,
we're so lucky. We don't have very far to go. I think, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the old missions, but I find that part of our history and that journey. I said to, when we came back from the Camino, I said, we need to get a donkey. And we'll start in San Diego, and we'll go up north. And then I found out there really were people doing it.
Wow.
And actually, there was a group that met at the mission a couple of years ago that was here. They were all Camino people.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the guest speakers was this guy and his partner who had walked up from San Diego.
Wow.
And the trouble is you have to walk through some pretty grungy places. I mean, walking through Spain is pretty good. But... you know, and many of the missions would let them camp there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we all have to think of those places
okay.
in our heart. it, Colin?
Well, last question, you said when you you say you pray, you read a text, you sing a song, and there is a fourth one.
Oh, you say a prayer.
Yeah.
You read a lection, and that many of us follow the lectionary, so it could be a daily reading.
Okay.
And a psalm of the day. Usually, again, that's from the lection. And then sing a song.
Oh, I have sing a song.
I think you missed the psalm. Did you get the psalm? So a prayer, a lection.
Okay.
A biblical reading, a psalm.
Oh, a psalm.
And then a song.
Oh, okay. That's right. Didn't hear.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We love you and we want you to come back. Both of you come back for the rest of the series. Next Thursday will be Reverend Suzanne Dunn. She is from the Beatitudes community, and she's going to be doing the chapter on reconnecting with spiritual practice. And again, if you have green, you're doing the honors next week for the food. Thanks so much, everybody.